Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. Margaret Taylor Ulisio, who holds a bachelor's degree and master's from Duquesne University and a PhD in systematic theology with a specialization in ecclesiology from Marquette University, my undergraduate alma mater. Go Warriors! After teaching part-time for over a decade, Dr. Taylor Ulisio began studying canon law, an interest that developed during her graduate studies in Milwaukee. She completed her JCL in canon law in 2015, writing her thesis on alternative dispute resolution in recourse against acts of administrative power. In 2016, Dr. Taylor Ulisio completed the New Jersey Association of Professional Mediators 40-hour training course in civil mediation, as well as a 10-week apprenticeship in civil mediation, handling cases up to $15,000. Dr. Taylor Ulisio has recently undergone the background clearance and has been approved as a court volunteer for the municipal court system in Mercer County, New Jersey, and is now working with other mediators. As a municipal court mediator, Margaret mediates cases between persons involving simple assault, harassment, criminal mischief, trespassing, and other ne'er-do-wellingness and scofflawing. In 2016, Dr. Taylor Ulisio founded CLAMS, which sounds like a delicious seafood treat, but is actually the Canon Law Advocacy and Mediation Services, CLAMS. She did this in order to use her competence in ecclesiology, canon law, and mediation to aid people in resolving their conflicts within their church. In addition to her volunteer work in the court system, Margaret continues to teach as a part-time instructor at Georgia Court University and also acts as an advocate in marriage nullity cases. We will link to Margaret's CLAMS website as well as other tasty treats over at our website, so please be sure to visit us. Margaret, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to have this opportunity to hopefully shed some light on a topic that people don't know much about.
Yeah, I don't know very much about it either, so this is really cool. I know, you know, you see lawyers on TV all the time, you know, Law and Order and all those other crime shows, but there's never a television show on canon law. There maybe one will come from this, I guess. I don't know. That'd be kind of cool.
Just as an aside, Law and Order is one of my favorite shows. And I watched it a lot when I was in canon law school. And there is at least one episode of Law and Order where they do address canon law, especially the marriage nullity process.
Ah, so it intersects with regular secular law in many places, right?
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit. In some ways it does.
Okay, very cool. So that's our goal for today, to learn about what it's like to be a canon lawyer. So here's my obvious first question is, what is a canon lawyer?
A canon lawyer is just someone who has specialized knowledge of canon law. I'm a Catholic, and so my specialization is in Catholic canon law, but there are other churches that have canon law. Canon law is just the internal law of the church. The Catholic Church has a very long tradition, canon law, and a very developed legal system.
How far does canon law date back? Does it date back to the very beginnings of the church? We're talking.
People would say that it dates back to the very beginning of Christianity. That even in Scripture, there are some laws, some instruction for how the community is supposed to be organized.
Now, I have to admit that my stereotypical image of a canon lawyer is that of a medieval monk in robes using a quill pen to write esoteric commentary about theology on a vellum sheet or something like that. But and since this goes back that far, that's the image I get, I guess. What does the modern canon lawyer look like?
I think even today, most canon lawyers are clerics. So a deacon, a priest, or a presbyter, or a bishop. But you're getting more diversity among canon lawyers now. So you'll see lay people, men and women, and religious sisters or nuns. but still there are not too many of those. I was speaking with someone who's a canon lawyer in the Diocese of Trenton, where I live, and he remarked that he believed that I was the only lay person that was a canon lawyer in this diocese of almost somewhere around 700,000 Catholics. I don't know if that's true, but you get a sense that even though there's some diversity, it's not really wide-reaching.
So in the Diocese of Trenton, you said there's about 700,000 Catholics. That's a pretty large number. You're the, as far as we know, the only lay canon lawyer out there. How many other canon lawyers are in the diocese? Do you know?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I have no way of knowing how to track the number of them. I mean, I've heard of people, but I don't think, I'm not aware that there's any database that counts them. There is a society, the Canon Law Society of America, and I'm not absolutely certain of the membership numbers, but it's over 1,000, but not all of those people are canon lawyers.
Oh. There's some people who are not canon lawyers who belong to the Canon Law Society? It just must be a fun thing to do. So
there are associate members.
Okay.
So there are people who work in tribunals but don't have a canon law degree.
Yeah.
Okay. There are also members who might have a specialization in ecclesiology, or not ecclesiology, but theology, who don't have a canon law degree but have an interest in canon law, and so they can be admitted as associate members.
Very interesting. What would an associate member do? They wouldn't be responsible for any cases or mediation, would they?
Well, the Canon Law Society of America is just a professional association.
Okay.
They have conferences, they sponsor research into canon law. So an associate member wouldn't have the same rights as a member, but they would have some access to the research. They might attend the conferences and stuff like that.
Okay. So there doesn't seem to be that many canon lawyers about the United States relative to the number of what could call secular lawyers. So it seems like a pretty cool thing to be involved in. Again, you got to help me out with my image of what a canon lawyer does. Do you get to go to the Vatican and drop off briefs and do arguments before the Pope or something like the big Supreme Court? Or what does it typically involve?
There are canon lawyers who do that, but I'm not one of them. And so most canon lawyers do not go to the Vatican. Just when you mentioned there are fewer canon lawyers relative to secular lawyers, there is only one school in the United States where you can get a canon law degree, which is the Catholic University of America.
Huh.
And my entering class only had 14 people in it. There are people in the United States who do go to other schools in other countries, but there aren't a lot of canon lawyers. There is a appellate court in the Vatican, the Roman Rota, and there's also the Apostolic Signatura, and they will decide cases that are presented to them in appeal. But what's different about canon law compared to American common law is that there's no precedent. So the way a case is decided on appeal doesn't determine the way other cases have to be decided. They don't bind you to make a certain decision, if that makes any sense.
You mentioned that there's only one place in the U.S. to go get a canon law degree. That's Catholic University, and that's where you did your canon law studies. But let's backtrack a little bit on your own biography, perhaps even going back to Duquesne University or maybe even further back. Tell us how you eventually ended up in the canon law profession, because I think, you know, if you ask anybody in third grade, they say, what do you want to grow up to be? Most people wouldn't say canon lawyer. So how'd you get there?
Well, as I said before, I'm Catholic, and I studied Catholic canon law. I was raised as a Catholic. I'm what people would call a cradle Catholic, from a Catholic family, Irish and Italian. But my interest in canon law didn't start in third grade. I think it kind of developed gradually as a young adult when I realized I had an interest in the church. I sort of had a conflicted feeling about the church, which is that it was a really great institution, but one that had a lot of problems at the same time. And I think that the struggle with that really encouraged me to pursue ecclesiology as an area of systematic theology, right? The study of the church, and then to go farther and study the internal structuring of the church, in the church's legal system.
What did you study at Duquesne University? Did you study theology?
I studied theology.
Okay. So you went all the way.
I have a BA, an MA, and a PhD in theology.
Well, straight through. And you went to Marquette University. Any reason for going to Marquette? I mean, again, that's my hometown school, so.
I applied there because I was interested in their emphasis on historical theology and how they incorporated historical theology into all their courses in theology. So it added a depth to all the courses, I thought, to look at the history and the development, even in systematic theology or in courses on doctrine.
Okay. How did you enjoy your time in Milwaukee? I have to ask, kind of on a personal basis, having grown up just outside of Milwaukee.
At first, I didn't like it. I am from Pennsylvania. I felt a little landlocked when I first moved there. But after maybe a year or so, I did really grow to enjoy it, and I liked it.
Yeah, I have to admit that growing up in Wisconsin, I couldn't wait the first opportunity to get out of there. So I had to go west.
Yeah, why is that?
It's just you growing up in your hometown, you wanted adventure. I was one of those go west young man type people. And so, you know, here I am now on the West Coast, happy as a clam, so to speak. And not feeling landlocked because we're right by the Pacific Ocean now. So, but very cool. Here's the interesting question, right? My son is about to go into college right now. He's a senior in high school. And if he came to me and told me that he's going to go into studying a degree in theology, I would probably freak out saying, whoa, there's no jobs there. Did your parents, were they pretty supportive in terms of you studying theology? Or they said, well, computer programming is the thing of the future. Shouldn't you, maybe you want to consider that.
Well, I have to say that when I initially went to college, I was a French major. So I don't know if that's any better than being a theology major. Mm-hmm. And I went for a few years, and then I quit because I wasn't really interested in it. And I thought I wasn't willing to put in the time or the money involved in getting the degree if I wasn't really committed to it. And it was only in my later 20s that I returned and started studying theology. So by that time, my parents really didn't have a reaction, right? I mean, I wasn't an 18-year-old going to study theology. I was a little bit more mature than that.
Okay. So you returned to study theology, and you studied systematic theology and ecclesiology, which is basically the field of your PhD studies. What is systematic theology? Is there a casual theology where you just kind of don't do it very systematically? And what is this ecclesiology stuff?
I don't know if there's a casual theology. I suspect there might be. But as you suggest, systematic theology looks at how doctrines form a coherent system of belief, how different doctrines, Christian doctrine, for example, Christology would be the study of Christ, and Trinitarian theology, the study of the Trinity, and soteriology, the study of salvation, and ecclesiology, which is the study of the church. And this isn't just all of the ologies in theology, but it looks at how all those different areas of belief relate to each other in a coherent way. And as I said, ecclesiology is the study of the church. And it's a later addition to systematic theology. I mean, as time went on within the history of Christianity, the focus on the church became greater. Right? People began studying the church as its own thing rather than just living the church.
Yeah, I can imagine as it gets bigger and bigger and more expansive, it becomes more and more of an interesting topic of study.
And also you get a lot farther removed from the original event. I think that also adds to it. Right, how the tradition exists over time, and the church is a big part of that.
So let me next ask you about this JCL. We mentioned that in your intro biography here. And what does JCL stand for?
It's a licentiate in canon law, and I will probably butcher it, even though I should be able to pronounce Latin. It's a juris canonici licentia.
Ooh, now that was very good. Much better than I could do, I can tell you that. So that's just like a JD, but for canon law.
For pretty close, yeah.
Okay. And you said you did that at Catholic University, the only place that in the United States that offers canon law training. What was it like? Was it like the typical law school? You take a couple years of classes, and over summertime you take an internship. What did the whole process of getting that canon law degree at Catholic University look like?
I think there are some similarities for sure. It is a three-year degree, which is similar to a civil law degree. Catholic University does have a civil law school, and we were required to take at least one course in this at the civil law school, which was really interesting. It was American law for canonists. They also have a program where you can simultaneously pursue a canon law degree and a law degree, but I did not go down that route. But it was 3 years of classes. The curriculum is set in universal law. So everybody who gets a canon law degree all over the world follows the same curriculum. There's the same requirements that are for everybody. I think people do internships. I didn't. I live in New Jersey, and when I was taking classes at Catholic University, I was commuting every day that I went there, which was about 200 miles a day one way. So it was, and I, at the time, my daughter was, when I started, was only five, and I also taught part-time. It was a pretty busy schedule for me. Like I said, it was mostly classes. You entered with a group of people, and for the most part, you went through the series of courses together with them. I was able to take some online courses. They allowed me to do that because I live so far away. I think there may be independent study. I didn't do any of that. My PhD was fulfilled a requirement that you need to have a background in theology, a certain amount of theology, in order to pursue the licentiate degree. So if you don't have that, you have to take a couple of years of courses of theology in order to enter for the licentiate.
And you probably cleared that up really quickly with a PhD in theology, right? You just walk in there and say, here's my PhD, and exempt me from those theology classes, right?
Yeah, I didn't have to take theology classes.
So you do all these courses, and they're all basically programmed for you, which makes class selection very easy. You don't have to fret over what class to take in any given semester. At the end of it, is there a bar exam just like secular lawyers would do here in the U.S.?
No, there's not a bar exam, but there are comprehensive exams, an oral comprehensive exam. The courses cover, for the most part, what is the Code of Canon Law. It's a code book that was promulgated in 1983, and it doesn't include all the laws in the Catholic Church. There are laws in the liturgical books and in other sources, but the comprehensive exams were designed to test your knowledge of the code. So there are, I should know offhand, 1,752 canons.
You could give me any number, I wouldn't know, so it sounds good.
That's what would be equivalent to a bar exam, I think. Right? Can you demonstrate, it's only 700. Oh, no, I'm right, 1752. So can you demonstrate knowledge of those 1,752 canons and how they relate to each other?
So the oral...
And you also had to write a thesis, sorry.
Oh, okay, so you had to write a thesis. What was your thesis on?
It was on alternative dispute resolution.
And what does that mean?
It means alternatives to either an administrative process or a judicial process. There's mention of mediation in canon law, in the Code of Canon Law, but there is no procedure outlined in canon law by which the church can actually mediate. So there's the mention, but it hasn't really been filled out or developed yet.
Okay. And as for the oral comprehensive exam, which is essentially the bar exam for canon law, they put you in a room where there are five priests up there asking you all these questions, and you had to know any given answer for all the 1752 canon laws out there? I mean, that'd be kind of intimidating.
It wasn't quite that bad.
Okay.
It was three priests, not five.
That makes it easier, though.
My doctoral qualifying exam at Marquette, it was five people.
Okay.
In canon law, it was only three, and I believe they were all priests.
Okay.
Canon law is broken into different books, the Code of Canon Law, and so it's a little more general than that. And you are allowed to have the code with you during the exam, but nothing else.
How thick is it? I mean, 752 could be pretty thin if it's just a few sentences each, but I imagine there's a lot of writing in here, and it's going to get pretty thick.
Well, my copy, you know, it has a lot of stuff in the back, and it also is in Latin, because the law is actually in Latin, and then there's an approved translation, but the translation is just a translation. The law itself is Latin.
Okay.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah. And do you read Latin very well?
Not real well, but I did have to take exams where I read Latin. I was able to answer in English, but I had to be able to read cases in Latin.
Wow. Okay.
So it's 538 pages. That's just the canon.
And it's in regular type. You didn't bring, like, one of the Code of Canon Laws from the 1400s with all those neat illustrations and fancy letters, did you?
No, because previous codes there was only one previous code, which was the 1917 code. But for the most part, when a new code is issued, the previous code is no longer in effect.
So that's interesting. How does that work then? You said the last one was written in 1983?
Mm-hmm.
And the previous one was 1917. What's the process of how one writes that canon law? Do a number of cardinals get together in the Vatican saying it's time to rewrite this thing, or what happens?
John Paul II was the responsible for issuing the 1983 Code of Canon Law. And the revision of the Code of Canon Law started after the Second Vatican Council. So it was the revision process was motivated and brought about by the changes in the Second Vatican Council. So it was bringing the church law in line with the documents of the Second Vatican Council. Canon law is always supposed to follow theology, and so, you know, the Second Vatican Council, there were documents, you know, on the church and on liturgy and so on, and then the updating or the revision of the code followed those changes.
Do you have any examples offhand of what change might have come from the Second Vatican Council, or, you know, a particular bit of canon law?
One thing that's pretty obvious is that there's more canons related to the role of the laity in the church. And I think that is probably a result of the Second Vatican Council and an emphasis on the role of the laity and their role in kind of bringing the gospel to the secular world and their secular identity. There was very little about the laity in the 1917 code.
What would a typical canon law be for the laity? Does it specify, here's what you can do and here's what you can't touch or anything like that?
Well, there's a section on the rights and obligations of the Christian faithful. It talks about, for example, things like parents' obligation towards their children, for the education of their children. It talks about their right to the spiritual goods of the church and stuff like that. Of course, there's a whole section on marriage, and there were canons on marriage in the 1917 code, and those canons also apply to the laity. Because it's the laity, at least in the Catholic Church, you know, clerics, for the most part, unless you're a deacon, they're not married, or if you're religious.
Now, that's one of the things that you do specialize in is marriage nullity cases, and we'll talk about that in a second here. But the next question I have for you is, what does the a canon lawyer do? What does a typical day of a canon lawyer look like? Give us a sense of the range of cases, topics, or issues somebody might come to your office or, you know, send you an email through your website saying, hey, I need a canon lawyer right now. Here's what I need to have done. What would you be doing?
Most canon law in the United States, and I don't know, I can't speak for it everywhere, but it's related to marriage nullity. This actually came as a big surprise to me because I wasn't particularly interested in marriage or the laws around marriage nullity when I started studying canon law. My interest was broader and more general, but almost all of canon law, I couldn't give you a percentage, is related to marriage nullity cases. But the code of canon law is really comprehensive, so it deals with pretty much every topic, right? It has penal law in it. It has law on temporal goods, right? How to transfer property. It has all the regulations for marriage, like we talked about, but what are the requirements for ordination? What are the requirements for becoming, you know, a bishop? What are all the procedural laws you have to follow? It's pretty comprehensive. So canon law could be any of those things. So there could be cases in any of those, but they're mostly related to marriage.
Yeah, I can imagine some really interesting cases where somebody's contesting the ordination of a priest or something, that they didn't follow a requirement X, Y, or Z, and that comes up, and somebody in the parish says, this person's not qualified because of that. That would be something that would come under the rubric of canon law, right?
Yes. That's interesting, though. I don't know. It would be hard to envision a lay person contesting the validity of an ordination. There are procedures related to kind of verifying the validity of ordination. It's not an area that I'm really familiar with, but in the same way that a marriage can be declared null, an ordination can also be declared null if there's some defect in it. I mean, the most obvious would be in the Catholic Church, a valid ordination can only apply to a man. But there are other things that are required for ordination, too. And if some of those would not be fulfilled, then there might be some grounds for declaring it null. But I can't imagine, because most lay people don't even probably know that it's possible to declare an ordination null. But they wouldn't even kind of have the basis for understanding challenging it. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, the reason I bring this up is because one of the churches I belong to did have a situation like this where the ordination was for a Protestant pastor was declared invalid because of not taking X, Y, or Z course or something like this. And so somebody in the congregation did know that. So I'm like, wow, okay, that's surprising. And I had the opportunity to watch that all play out firsthand. And it is kind of interesting because they like to handle it within the denomination or within the church itself. Is there any time that some of these cases bleed over into the regular secular U.S. court system? Somebody might say, wait a minute, we tried resolving this in the canon law court, but, you know, it really represents a contract, and there's secular contract law that's out there, so we're going to move this case into the regular court system downtown.
I think that there's certainly some overlap, and this might not address exactly the question, but when I was thinking about whether or not there was any kind of overlap between canon law and civil law, the case a couple of years ago of the property in Los Angeles, I don't know if you heard about that, there was a religious congregation, I believe the Sisters of the Most Holy and Immaculate Heart of the Blessed Virgin Mary, that had a property that was worth over $10 million that they had owned for, I think, some time. And there was a dispute about who had the right to sell it, the religious sisters or the bishop, the archbishop. The archbishop wanted to sell it to Katy Perry, and this is probably why the case got a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And the sisters didn't want to sell it to her because they saw a video with her in it or something, and I don't think they liked it. But I think that the civil court determined who had the right to sell it based on canon law and how property ownership is understood within canon law. So they used the canon law to make a decision.
Wow. Absolutely fascinating. I've never heard of this court case, and I'm going to have to look into it because I'm very interested in religious property cases and involving Katy Perry. I have to admit, I am not a Katy Perry fan, but if I could sell my house for several million dollars to Katy Perry, I think that price would be right. I'd sell it right away. But
I think that the courts ruled in favor of the Archbishop.
Okay.
But I'm not sure whether the sale to Katy Perry went through.
Ah.
I think it was 2015 that this dispute was happening.
Wow. What would Katy Perry want a convent for? I don't know.
I think it was a really nice property.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, tear it all down so you can have a nice ocean view or something like that. That happens in Los Angeles all the time. So something to look into. Very, very cool. Well, I want to move on to something that you say you specialize in quite a bit and that you were surprised that you would be specializing in quite a bit, and that's the issue of marriage nullity cases. Explain what all of this entails and give us perhaps some examples, respecting the privacy of clients and that, but kind of a typical amalgamated case of what a marriage nullity case would look like.
This is probably the area of canon law that most people are familiar with. In the marriage nullity cases, you have either the former wife or the former husband who petitions the church to make a judgment. It's a legal judgment about the validity of their marriage in order to pursue an annulment. That's how it's popularly understood. People call it an annulment in the Catholic Church. You already have to be divorced. And so there's no secular lawyer involved in it. There are different reasons why people pursue a decree of nullity or an annulment. A lot of times they want to remarry within the church. And if you have been married and you've followed proper canonical form, you have to get a decree of nullity in order to be free to marry again. Some people pursue an annulment because they really want to have complete closure on the marriage that they had entered into. And so even though they're divorced, they want the extra, confirmation where the church decrees that it was null.
So let me get this clear first. You mentioned that you have to have a divorce first. So the divorce goes through civil courts first, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
They won't look at a case if there's not a civil divorce.
So what does the typical a nullity case look like? How would it go through the whole canon law system from the moment somebody contacts you till the moment it's resolved?
If you're talking about a typical marriage nullity case, you might not have a canon lawyer involved in the very beginning steps of the case. A lot of times you have parishes or the diocese who will have help people fill out the petition. So basically what happens is when a person decides they want to pursue a decree of nullity or an annulment, they might approach their pastor or they might go to the website of the diocese, and there's forms that they can download and fill out. And they could just, in some cases, they could just download forms and fill them out and submit them without having any contact with a canon lawyer. Sometimes they'll approach their pastor, and there will be people who are trained within the parish who do not have degrees in canon law who will help them fill out the paperwork and submit it. I think, though, that there are reasons why somebody would contact a canon lawyer first.
And what would those reasons be?
Because I think canon lawyers have a better knowledge of the law, and I think that certainly in some cases there are advantages to having someone who is more familiar with the law help the petitioner from the very beginning of the case. A typical case would go through there's certainly going to be canon lawyers involved, but a typical case would just, you'd have someone petition and you wouldn't have a lot of issues. Say someone petitioned and they had an ex-spouse who was really okay with the whole thing and participated, and, you know, there were clear grounds and their evidence was very clear, that would be an easy case. But many times you'll have, for the Diocese of Trenton, I'm not employed by them, but I work on a contract basis as an advocate for respondents who are opposed to the process of the annulment. So these are people who are contesting either the annulment itself or some of the grounds. And I know that a lot of things I haven't explained here. So you have a petitioner, and they request the annulment. It can be either the former husband or former wife. And then the person who doesn't request the annulment, who isn't the petitioner, is the respondent. Sometimes the respondent wants to have nothing to do with the process at all. And that is okay, provided that they were cited or notified that their ex-spouse was petitioning for an annulment. So you can't, it wouldn't be a valid process if someone petitioned for an annulment and there wasn't at least an attempt to cite their former spouse. So, but sometimes what happens is the former spouse either doesn't agree with the reasons that are given or they oppose the annulment altogether. And so that's going to add some complications to the case.
Now, that's interesting to me because I would sit here and wonder if, you know, we're already divorced in a civil sense, and then somebody says, you know what, I just want to finish this process, I'll bring it to closure, let's get an annulment. Why would anybody want to contest something like that?
I think, you know, I haven't been a canon lawyer for a really long time, but there are a lot of different reasons I'm discovering for why people contest an annulment. I kind of have the same reaction that you do, which is that the divorce has already happened. I think the likelihood, in at least in any of the cases that I've seen, that these people are going to reconcile is probably nothing. So why contest it? Because people have different ideas about what it means to get an annulment. I think some people who have children have concerns that if they get an annulment, that that has some bearing on the legitimacy of their children, which it doesn't.
Hmm.
I think some people just want to make things hard for their ex. And if it's a way to make things difficult, then they'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they have the means to make things difficult. I think some people disagree with the ground, right? They might not oppose the annulment itself, but they oppose the reasons that are given for the annulment. So when a person petitions for an annulment, they write kind of a narrative about their marriage and things that happened before their marriage. In the Roman Catholic Church, consent makes the marriage. And so most nullity cases look at whether or not there was some defect in consent. And so things that happen after a marriage, if there's evidence that there was a defect in consent, then it's relevant. But in and of itself, somebody turning into a horrible person after the fact isn't really going to be grounds for an annulment. There's also a thing called defect in canonical form, which is all Catholics are required to follow canonical form when they get married or to get a dispensation from canonical form. That means that you have to be married, you know, just generally speaking, in a church with a deacon or a priest, and you have to have followed these certain rules that's called canonical form. And if you don't do that without a dispensation, then your marriage is not valid. So you can get a dispensation, though. So a Catholic can get married in a Protestant church, but they have to have a dispensation, which is a relaxation of a law.
I can imagine where that would happen if you're in the middle of Nowheresville, Alaska, and there's no Catholic parish around. They say, yeah, can we get married in this church? And they're like, okay, we'll write you an exception for that one.
A layperson can witness a marriage in cases like that.
Okay.
So it wouldn't even be that you'd have to, well, it's sort of complicated. But, I mean, if you really are isolated, there are ways that you can basically marry each other, provided that once you have access to a priest, you kind of formalize it. So the church would say that even if you're living in Antarctica and you have absolutely no access to canonical form, that doesn't prohibit you from being married, because marriage is a right and kind of a natural right that a person has.
Any other reasons or grounds for an annulment that would violate that? Yeah, you mentioned defect in consent. Actually, what would defect in consent look like?
There's different defects in consent. So there's defects in the capacity to consent, and then there's defects in the exchange of consent. I think most cases talk about defect in capacity. So there's like lack of due discretion, incapacity to fulfill the essential obligations of marriage for a psychological reason. So there'd be some reason either that you didn't understand what marriage was when you consented, or if you understood what it was, you didn't have the capacity to actually fulfill doing what it was. And if that's the case, then you can't give valid consent. And then there's other things like the defects in exchange. If you are marrying a person and they're actually not the person you think they're marrying, so if a person has lied about who they are, then that would invalidate consent.
Okay. Here's a couple of interesting questions. You say you've been doing this for a little while, but you probably have a sense of what is going on. Who tends to initiate these annulments more, the husband or the wife?
I don't know if there's a breakdown between which gender initiates more often. I haven't really seen that. Not always, and I mentioned this before. A lot of times what happens is people petition for an annulment if they want to remarry in the church. Just as an aside, only about 15% of the people who are eligible to petition actually do petition. So you have a large number of Catholics who are divorced who would be eligible to petition for an annulment who just do not go through the process, who either remarry either in another church or before a JP, Justice of the Peace, or don't remarry at all.
Now, you mentioned that most of the annulments that come before the church are actually granted. Are there some reasons where they may not be granted?
If there's no evidence to support the ground, then it would not be appropriate for a judge to make an affirmative decision in the case. So what happens is you petition, you cite the respondent, and you set the grounds. Of all the possible grounds, you identify which ones apply to this particular case based on the narrative and other questions that the petitioner has answered. And that's why it's probably a good idea, especially if there's an anticipation for a complicated case, for a petitioner to contact a canon lawyer, because I think that most canon lawyers will have a broader grasp of the grounds than someone who isn't trained in canon law. I mean, there's a tendency to kind of refer to the same grounds all the time and to not really explore other grounds that people are less familiar with. And a canon lawyer might be able to make an argument that some of these other grounds might fit the case and be able to be an advocate for their client for grounds that, maybe most people wouldn't look at. So they set the grounds. And there are certain types of proofs that are acceptable to the ground. And that's basically how the case goes, right? You have the facts of the case, you have the law, and then you have, which is the grounds, and then you have whether or not the law supports the facts of the case.
Here's a little personal question. How many of these marriage annulment cases have you done over the past several years?
Right now, I have probably 10 or 12.
Okay.
like in the works at different places.
And I'm just kind of ask you, psychologically, how does that affect you? Because I've talked to a lot of pastors and priests, and oftentimes they're asked to carry the weight of the world. People come to talk to their pastor when they have problems, not when everything is going really well. So a lot of times you have to bear the burdens of these individuals, you know, stress and difficult times and that. Is it difficult to kind of, you know, deal with these cases and say, oh my gosh, I'm kind of seeing the dark side or the underside of life here, or, you know, difficulties in marriage, when I know marriage can be a really great thing, but I only see the darker sides of it. Is that somewhat burdening?
Sort of. I think that's an interesting question. And I think that, you know, the way that you phrased it now kind of brings a lot of things to mind for me. I am married, and I know a lot of happily married people. And so I think that I have a fairly broad view of marriage. One of the things that was pretty disturbing for me going through the canon law program was that there was virtually no married people there. Mm. And so was all the discussion about marriage was from the dark side. And it was sort of frustrating to me. You know, I'm sure that unmarried people know something about marriage, but it was sort of frustrating that the people who spend all the time making judgments about other people's marriage really had kind of an unbalanced view of it, because it was almost always from the dark side.
Yeah.
So for me, the difficult part was actually sitting in classes. Engaging with people who are going through the process has not been a negative experience for me, because I think it's helping them.
Mm.
You know, and I get to engage with people in a more practical way that helps them. So, I mean, so far, it hasn't been a negative experience for me.
Okay.
It's certainly a better experience in many ways, and the experience in canon law school wasn't bad. I mean, like I said, I commuted a long distance and it was quite busy, but I prefer practicing canon law than I did going to canon law school.
Yeah, the practice is always funner than school. School can kind of suck sometimes, but let me ask you about the practice then. You recently started your own business called the Canon Law Advocacy and Mediation Service, or CLAMS, which, by the way, is an awesome acronym. Did you actually aim for that acronym? You like CLAMS or something, and so we guess fit the acronym?
I like roosters.
Okay.
the CLAMS was purely accidental.
Okay. Yeah, I have to admit, too, on the website, you do see roosters on there, and I'm looking at clams, and then there's these birds, and I'm like, that something doesn't quite fit there. Tell us a little bit about what it's like to set up your own business like that, because I've never done that, and I'm always fascinated by the entrepreneurship that has to go on behind this.
Setting up the business was pretty easy. I mean, I went on to a website. I don't even remember exactly which one. There's some way to do an LLC in the state of New Jersey, and I filled out the paperwork and I submitted my fee, and then I had a business. Because I'm the only person in my business, it's essentially no different than just me as an individual, you know, providing canon law services, if that makes any sense. So, you know, like for tax purposes and that kind of thing, it's just, there's nothing special to do.
Yeah. So there you are. You hung up your shingle, as they used to say back in medieval times, right? Your little placard outside the office. But this one is an electronic one that appears on the website. Mm-hmm. How do you find clients? Do they find you, or do you go out shopping for them? I can almost imagine, you know, a canon lawyer kind of be like one of the ambulance chasers hanging around the offices of the divorce office at the city hall and saying, hey, by the way, are you Catholic? Can I help you? Or how do you get your clients?
Well, I have a contract with the Diocese of Trenton, and so I get clients from them. And I have gotten some clients from advertising, and I will probably do some more advertising. I've advertised in, I believe, one Catholic publication, but I think that I'll probably do more advertising. partly because the clientele I want to reach are lay people. I think that there's probably plenty of canon lawyers, even though there aren't very many canon lawyers, that serve clerics and religious, and there are very few that are dedicated to serving the needs of lay people. Lay people are becoming more and more involved in the church. And remember, canon law doesn't just deal with marriage and marriage nullity. So there are other issues that might be significant for lay people, you know, employment-related things, you know, access to sacraments, issues about educating their educating children. So there are other areas in canon law that might make a person contact a canon lawyer. So I think that I will try some outreach or advertising.
Yeah. Yeah, advertising sounds really horrible, but outreach sounds really good. So doing that outreach, we'll have to kind of follow along with that and see how your business grows and what are kind of cases that you have. Let me finish off with one closing question, though, and I always like to ask my guests this. You've been through a lot of education at three different institutions, and you set up your own business. You've handled a bunch of cases over the years. Looking back, is there anything that you have learned that has surprised you or has changed your mind about human nature or your own religious faith throughout this whole experience?
I think that in many ways the educational process made me a bit cynical, which surprised me because I had a view of my faith that made me believe that it was impervious to cynicism. But I think that now that some time has elapsed, and that I'm engaged with people on a more practical level, that some of the cynicism surrounding the education is starting to dissipate a bit. But I was surprised at how cynical I became, especially during the canon law program. I don't want to say anything. It's not that it wasn't positive in many ways, but as you say, a lot of times what law looks at is the dark side of things, and some of it is kind of surprising.
Yeah. But when you get out there in the world where you're actually helping people, I guess that could help erase some of that cynicism, and if you have some successful cases that come to happy resolution, then, hey, you know, can rekindle your optimism in humanity once again, I guess.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, my guest today has been Margaret Taylor Luzio. Margaret, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.